What's up, people? I'm Erica, and this is Cocktails and Capitalism, a podcast that pairs crafted beverages with stories distilled from our capitalist hellscape. Today, we're going to be talking about Tori's reaction. Hell yeah.
Sorry, I love it.
Dude, I'm so excited to be talking with you right now. Oh my God, this is a long time coming. I'm talking with Tori Sue. Tori Sue is a climate justice activist, researcher, speaker, and writer who grew up in Hong Kong and is now based in the UK. She's the author of the amazing book we'll be discussing today called It's Not Just You, How to Navigate Eco-Anxiety and the Climate Crisis. Tori traveled across the Atlantic with the environmental think tank Sail to the COP. She's also the co-founder of the Bad Activist Collective, a group of changemakers, storytellers, and artists fighting for the liberation of people and the planet while dismantling activist perfectionism. On top of all of her organizing work, Tori was recently featured in Billie Eilish's documentary Overheated, in which she spoke about climate change and its relationship to mental health. She was even featured on the Vogue 2023 cover alongside Billie Eilish and seven other climate activists. And I understand that, you know, pointing that out, that's not even kind of the more substantial activist work that you've done, but it's just such an interesting thing that you were able to be part of that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much, Erica. And oh my God, what a time to live in this capitalist hellscape. I have to commend you on accurately describing the time that we're in. But yeah, you know, it's really interesting kind of what piques people's interest with some of the work that I do. And I guess just in the spirit of being transparent, it's definitely what some of the more liberal environmentalists kind of love to hear. They're like, oh yeah, let's talk about that kind of stuff instead of the stuff that's kind of like the bread and butter of what I'm fighting for and what I try to do. But it is something that kind of almost makes me question, hey, like, are climate activists now making it into the mainstream? Is this something that will put us on a path towards, bringing more sort of climate justice into the fore? That's something I'm constantly interrogating, and I'm like, is all publicity good publicity? Is it not? Is it bad? I don't know. It's a lot of things I think about.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it's a really, really important thing. I mean, sometimes, you know, there's a lot of valid critiques of idolizing individuals rather than, you know, just uplifting movements and collectives, but when there is an individual who has a spotlight and is willing to be a good ally to causes, that's a really powerful thing. So, I'm not in any way opposed to building those bridges with people who have that voice, you know?
Sure.
It's really fucking cool. Yeah. And today we are drinking the It's Not Just You cocktail. And it is lovely. I'm going to put the sparkling water into mine right now.
Oh, delightful. Yeah. So I've already been sipping on mine. Actually really good.
I didn't make mine alcoholic, but I kind of wish I did because I'm already having so much fun with you. Even though it's like 9 a.m. for me, I may run in there and get some booze. So this cocktail is made with three spirit Leivner, non-alcoholic spirit, grapefruit juice, lime juice, rose tea syrup, a dash of rose water, and sparkling mineral water. But Tori, you brought up in our exchanges that you were not going to use grapefruit juice. And I want to open up the floor for you to just explain why.
Yeah, for sure. It's not that I have a personal vendetta against grapefruit juice. I actually quite like grapefruit. It's just I can't take grapefruit. I can't eat or ingest grapefruit because of the medication I'm on, which is so niche, right? Like, you think of all the things that could potentially interfere with the medication that you take. The last thing that would be on your mind is a fruit. And I'm on SSRIs, and I've been on them for another way of saying antidepressants. Mm-hmm. And I've been on them for, oh my God, over a decade. And it's a really topical thing because I was put on them without my consent. I was put on them, against my consent. And as someone who's rode the highs and lows of what it is to be someone who's, I call myself a mad person. I'm, you know, a bit of a reclamation of the term. It's something that I've really had to interrogate within myself, is like, oh, is this how we as a society have come to essentially medicate people against the ills of this world, as opposed to, you know, actually addressing the material conditions that are making people unwell. That's not me denouncing that mad people don't exist. Like, even outside of capitalism, we will always have mad folks. But it's just, I think, the exacerbation of madness within the paradigms of capitalism is something I think about a lot. And, you know, being on this medication kind of non-consensually has been a real journey for me. And trying to come off them has been an even more tricky journey, because the withdrawal effects are just horrendous. And, you know, we put people on drugs without really thinking about what the long-term impacts are. So
we're telling them what the long-term impacts are.
Right, exactly.
I've dealt with the same thing before. And the very, very difficult process of getting off of something that's no one warned me about.
Right, exactly. And, you know, again, this is, you know, complete disclaimer. It's not me saying that there is no efficacy to drugs, that people don't have a right to access them. I mean, sometimes when people are living in truly unlivable conditions, every person has that right to access things that make it more bearable to survive. Yeah, it's a conversation around the system that we're in, and why we live in a neoliberal capitalist society, which has commodified forms of treatment instead of actually addressing the elephant in the room, which is the system itself. And there's also loads of research to back up the fact that actually there is no sort of hallmark biochemical marker which designates that these drugs are tackling chemical imbalances in the brain, so to speak. It's not to say that there aren't neurotransmitters involved, but research over the years has actually found that this biochemical model of mental health illness that people have purported is not scientifically validated. In fact, there are so many peer-reviewed papers out there which have shown that there's no sort of underlying biochemical reason for everyone's mental health illness. But it's very convenient for the society that we live in to say, hey, you're unwell. You know, it's not the system that's making you unwell. It's it's the fact that you as an individual are biochemically malnourished, and we need to rectify that through capital means. So, it's very interesting thing to be on something that makes you question the world around you.
Definitely. Oh my gosh. And thank you for sharing that. And, you know, one of the things I really appreciate about everything that I've read or seen from you, I mean, so much of your work, you are very transparent with your own mental health issues. And I think that, you know, helps to really destigmatize a lot of these things, because I don't, I don't think I know a single person who is just like mentally well in this world that we're living in, you know?
Oh my God. Yeah.
And so the fact that you are open and you are thoughtful and compassionate about the reality that we are all struggling, your openness just is really, really beautiful. And
Thank you.
I think really important for people.
You know what? You really hit the nail on the head there. I can't name a single person who is well in this society right now. It is truly an exceptional thing. And on the subject of wellness, we live in a world where this idea of health, this idea of wellness is very much through a particular lens. It's like, as I mentioned, through an individualized lens. And for, you know, for people listening who kind of use TikTok, I don't know if you've seen the sort of trends that come and go, but one of them was this thing called the It Girl. I don't know if you've heard of it before. Yeah. And it's this sort of concept that you can be the It Girl too if you get up at 6 a.m. and you do yoga and meditation and you drink your smoothie and health is in your hands, and like, you're unwell because you choose to be unwell. And it just really lacks this kind of intersectional systemic analysis of what wellness actually entails, and how, again, in this capitalist society, we've been quite frankly indoctrinated into believing that wellness is a personal endeavor, not a collective one. And so, you know, you see it everywhere from like self-care kits and all that. So it's not necessarily mutually exclusive to like the collective care that we deserve. But it's an overarching thing that I feel really does a disservice to what people need right now.
Yeah. And I know we're going to dive a little more deeply into that. But I think that's so important just to lay out even early in this conversation that the individualization of problems is something that you shine light on so much in the book, and how at odds it is with the reality that our issues stem from a system that is isolating us and making us unwell every single day. So
100%.
Yeah. And I love that framing. It's beautiful and absolutely right. Everything, your book just resonated so hard with me. I don't even know how to say it. Like,
thank you.
I've been, after doing my dissertation, I've been so burnt out over the last 5 years where I don't want to read books. And like, I'm consuming a lot of information, but I'm not sitting down to read a novel or, you know, a deep philosophical book. But yours was so both accessible and incredibly philosophical.
Thank you.
And it struggled with all of these deep concepts that I'm constantly thinking about, you know, nature versus society, and how we separate ourselves from the bigger whole, and then become unwell in that reality, and how capitalism does that to us. So
literally.
I just, everyone go get that book. Go read this book. It is one of the best books I've read in my whole life.
Oh, that's so kind. Thank you. That's honestly so kind and really heartwarming to hear. As someone who, I think I put this book out as kind of more of a collective testament to the climate justice movement, which I can kind of speak about in due course. But I put this book out with a lot of people in mind. I really see it as a collective project in many ways, but the way in which we live in this world and the way things are marketed is always very much like, oh, who wrote this book? And, you know, look at them and all the stuff that they're doing. And it was an interesting thing because, you know, I felt like I had to really toe the line between making this book accessible to people who are in the environmental space, who are worried about their mental health in relation to the climate crisis, but also try and offer something for folks who are already engaged in the conversation. And that was such a difficult thing to do.
Oh my God, you fucking nailed it. You really, seriously, I was thinking about that exact thing as I was reading it.
Oh, bless you. That's so kind because, you know, In all transparency, I did something that is very taboo in the writing world. And my book editor, who is such an incredible comrade, reminded me to never do this in my entire writing career. I read the reviews.
Oh, no.
I know. I mean, there were some nice ones, don't get me wrong, but there were equally so. And the reason why I say equally is because I really don't believe that anyone is above criticism. And that might sound very virtuous, but genuinely, I put that book out in the world knowing fully that it was not something that I was like, this is unapologetically me. This is something that, you know, in 20 years time, I will look back on it and it will still be completely relevant. I knew that it wouldn't age as well as I would like. And one thing that really made me laugh, it made me sad and it made me laugh, was there was this person who was clearly a very staunch leftist, completely empathized with the politics that they were coming from here, but she was just like, this book would have been better if it taught me a recipe for a Molotov cocktail. That made me laugh so much because I was just like, yeah, fair play. You know, there's like, it's really hard to navigate. And I got asked this question not too long ago about like, do climate activists condone violence? And maybe that sort of me going fair play is like an insinuation that I do condone violence. But it was more, it was more, I think, the fact that it was speaking to how this person was feeling fatigued about how many concessions are made for the elite and for the industries that are completely decimating our planet. And for those of us who walk this tightrope of feeling like, are we radical enough? Are we too radical? Are we, I'm someone who occupies a lot of different spaces. Like, I know in my heart what my politic tells me, but equally so, I found that I've had to navigate being in spaces where literally some of the things that I say would shut people down in an instant, or they would just switch off. They're like, I don't understand that. You know, you're talking about capitalism. What has capitalism got to do with the environment? And so I ended up writing a book that I feel like was, at least some form of starting point for some people. And then for others, I hope, like, gives them a new perspective. Insofar as offering anything completely radical or completely new in terms of perspective, I can totally understand why some people might be like, we need more. We need more. And equally so, some people saying, this is too much. I mean, I had one review online that was like, this is far too academic, far too academic. And then my book editor, I was just like, as like someone who's pretty radical in my politics, and I was very lucky to have such an incredible editor, they were just like, it's really not that academic. I can show you academic.
Yeah. I've so read academic.
Yeah.
The thinkers that you cite, the even, you know, modern thinkers, influencers online who are talking about these topics. I mean, they're always very accessible points that you're trying to make with all these things. I think it's too bad that you've gotten that critique, because I think that the book did such a beautiful job of like gracefully and very clearly showing how any true work to dismantle environmental injustice in this world is going to really need to go to the root cause, right, as you point out, and root meaning, I think you point out in the book, it's radical, a radical source. And so the source of so many of our issues is capitalism. So
completely.
You introduce people to the idea very smoothly. And so much of what I'm trying to do is introduce the same ideas. You mentioned when we were talking earlier, a Trojan horse for talking about these things. Like, that is what I'm trying to do by sharing stories and things.
Right. Yeah.
And it's so hard to not turn people away when you start saying things like capitalism, socialism, anything like those big concepts that just like turn off.
It's thank you. I really appreciate that. And also, I'm also trying to like reassure myself that actually people are hungry for those words. And I say people, I mean like people who haven't previously engaged with the conversation in that way. I think they are, because I think people are realizing that the solutions that have been touted are not the solutions that are actually going to serve everyone. Like a good example of that is, you know, I speak about the surge of electric vehicles, for instance, and that's just essentially capitalism with a green denominator. You're still having exploitation. You're still destroying ecosystems. You're putting, land defenders at risk. And we're seeing what's happening in Congo for, you know, mining coltan, and we're seeing what's happening in the Lithium Triangle in Latin America, in the Andes, where people are, you know, mining lithium. So I think people are hungry for these solutions as well. Solutions that really do get at the root. And one of the reasons why, you know, I kind of called this book a bit of a Trojan horse is because it has this popular term on the cover, eco-anxiety. It's something that has kind of seen a surge in the Western conscience over the last few years, particularly people who are environmentally minded, so to speak, feeling like, oh, they're really nervous about the future of the planet. They're nervous about what's happening, you know, as a kind of simplistic definition of eco-anxiety. I just felt like it was a form of talking about the relationship between that which we call mental health and the climate crisis, perhaps in a way that didn't necessarily serve the breadth and the fullness of just how endemic these issues are. Not only did it at times feel like a watered down explanation, or perhaps a more palatable explanation of what's actually happening, but it also feels like something that is not going to bring liberation to peoples everywhere, because not everyone relates to it, and for good reason, which I can get into in a second.
Yeah.
But, you know, writing this book felt like an opportunity to slap the word eco-anxiety on the front cover is hopefully a way for people to read it. And then they end up reading a book about climate justice, which some people were happy about, you know, some people weren't so happy about.
Can't please everyone, man.
No, definitely not.
And in line with what you're saying about there being an appetite for this, of real interest in this concept right now, can you talk about just kind of the common conception of eco-anxiety, the common perception, before we kind of break down a little bit some of the problems and intricacies of that concept?
For sure. You know, there are so many definitions of eco-anxiety across many bodies. And the thing that's perhaps one of its biggest downfalls is that there are so many definitions that it's really hard to pin down. But when you kind of start to coalesce these definitions and look for similar themes, the reoccurring themes are, you know, this fear, this worry, this anxiety almost of what's happening to the planet, more often than not related to the climate crisis. But also I've noticed an element of fearful of the future, this worry for what's to come. Now, not all definitions kind of adhere to that. In fact, when I kind of, you know, operate in spaces which understand the limitations of eco-anxiety, I tend to actually go for a definition that's used by the Climate Psychological Association, which describes it as the mental and somatic distress owed to dangerous changes in the climate system, just because it emphasis there is on the somatic, which I really like as well. And also there's no sort of direct tie to the future, which I think can be a really big disservice to people sometimes. And, you know, despite that definition, it's not the one that's typically employed. And it's also not a term that really spotlights those who are on the front lines of the climate crisis. I mean, it's not to say it doesn't exist in those environments. After all, if we're going to talk about the future, surely those people have the most to be worried about. So therefore, they're more likely to be eco-anxious. But when you actually look at who's represented in these conversations, it's very rarely Black and brown people or Indigenous folks or people on the front lines of this crisis. And like I said before, it doesn't speak fully to the realities that many people face, whether it be because of its emotional limitations, like what other emotions and experiences are people enduring? Is only the future that people are worried about? Does that speak to the history of how the climate crisis has come about and the many environmental injustices that have led to where we are now? Does it also encapsulate the environment and the climate as it has come to be known for people on the front lines? Because to many, it's not simply just the physical manifestations of a dying planet. It's very much the social injustices and the compounding of many systemic oppressions that have occurred over the years. So, yeah, it's almost like the book is almost like a dissection of the word, a hyper dissection, and what it has come to represent in a time such as now.
You do that so beautifully. Maybe we can start kind of talking about some of the problems with this concept by diving into the topic you just brought up, like the futurity of the concept and how that futurity is somewhat racist and Eurocentric and how it leaves folks out. I mean, you kind of already touched on that, but yeah.
Yeah, for sure. That's a really good question, because I feel like when it comes to the narratives around climate change and what you see in popular media, more often than not, it usually fixates on this sort of idea that, you know, the worst is yet to come. And not only does that speak to the environment in a sort of physical sense, when, you know, we think of natural disasters, and which I actually like to call unnatural disasters, quite frankly.
Yeah.
But it also doesn't speak to the realities of people who have undergone severe and profound trauma and loss and grief as a result of what some in the West might consider the conventional hallmarks of climate change. But also the things that are linked, very heavily linked to that, such as extractivist economies and, quite frankly, genocide. You know, when we see those who have undergone the most profound mental traumas, it's not necessarily represented in the Western media just because of the lack of research, but more often than not, it's land defenders and people who have been living in tandem with the land for a long time, people who have undergone, you know, genocide, people who have been moved off their land. And eco-anxiety in some instances can feel like too small a term, or not an accurate representation, I think, of what it actually means to have that relationship be severed from the land. Mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily speak to the reality that there are people who have undergone really extreme traumatic loss.
Yeah, already.
Yeah, exactly. And you see that reflected in the media. I think, you know, I wrote in the book how a few summers ago there was some extreme flooding that happened in Belgium, Germany, I think also the Netherlands. And not to absolutely say that these things weren't atrocities and extremely difficult for many people, but the news headlines were all, the climate crisis is finally here. And it's like, I can recount so many headlines that were missing from front page news where there were people from the global south or other black and brown folks who would never make it onto the front covers, and they would never ever say the climate crisis is finally here. Because you have to ask, the climate crisis finally here for whom? You know, I feel like eco-anxiety can play into that narrative. But I also do want to reiterate, and I think I was mentioning this at the start, it's not to say it doesn't exist. It's not to say that there are marginalized people who don't experience eco-anxiety. It's just we need to give, you know, a faithful representation of what this term can actually entail. It's, you know, positives, it's limitations. But expand the discourse to understand that it's not just the future, it's not just anxiety as we know it, it's not just so-called natural disasters, and it's not also just climate change, you know? Like, how many of these things, and I make this argument in the book, how many of these things that we're experiencing right now, if we really get to the root of it, are caused by this capitalist system that we live in? And is eco really the best sort of prefix for the term? Like, Is it really just like environmental in the sort of Western sense, or is it like really this systemic issue that we're enduring, and eco-anxiety is just a product of living in this society in a time such as now? So, you know, sometimes I say I'm eco-anxious, but for the most part, I'm like, I'm just unwell from living in this system. You know?
Totally. Absolutely. I definitely feel like the term resonates with me, even though it is limited in a lot of ways. I mean, I feel like my whole life I've been aware of impending climate catastrophe. And you know, I grew up in Indonesia where I was watching like the palm oil being extracted and just absolutely destroying these beautiful, incredible rainforests, some of the most biologically diverse places on the planet.
Right.
And with these orangutans who are like so close to humans, just watching them just being decimated, being wiped off the face of the earth, like, is broke my heart so much that like, I don't know, there probably is a bigger term that would catch all of what I'm feeling there.
Sure.
But it's not just eco-anxiety. It's like rage at a world where this is just keeps happening and there's nothing I can do about it, and the powers that be don't care.
You know? Right. Like, yeah. That rage is something that I really feel. And it's something actually that I talk about and I spoke about in the book, that actually the majority of people that I interviewed, the majority of climate justice activists, felt like rage was something they felt much deeper than anxiety.
Yeah.
And I think it's from enduring and seeing that injustice time and time and time again. And, you know, when you were mentioning orangutan, it's something that I think speaks to something that I wrote in the book, which is this severed connection between so-called us and other species and the planet that we live in. And I think that that separation, that dualism between us and nature is also part of such a profound suffering, not only in ourselves, but in others, so to speak. And orangutan literally means like person of the forest. But yet people who are, you know, the multi-billion dollar conglomerates that run the palm oil industry do not see these creatures, these people, as you know, beings. They just see them as vermin, quite frankly. And, you know, the animal analogy is something that is used to dehumanize human beings as well. You know, as we're seeing with the ongoing genocide in Palestine, you know, the way that people talk about the Palestinians as animals. And it's kind of, it's on the one hand, it's like, don't you dare talk about human beings like that. But also, like, animals are also people too in their own rights, you know, if we're going for a total liberation framework here. And I argue in the book that, yeah, just these profound separations that we have from not only our land and people, but also our non-human kin is part of the reason I think that people are suffering so profoundly.
Yeah.
Yeah, we live in a society where it's been very convenient to create these dualisms, because without it, it would be harder to exploit. And without exploitation, we wouldn't have capital. So, yeah.
Yeah, you really see with the orangutan example, the like commodification of nature and how this just objectifies everything and just destroys everything, and how easily humans can slip into that same paradigm, and how we other each other in addition to other animals, other, you know, environments and things.
Yeah, for sure.
Which is why, like, I love when I see people sharing the message that, you know, we're not protecting nature, we're nature defending itself.
Truly. Yeah.
I think that kind of awareness that is growing right now gives me so much hope and really like just fills my heart, you know?
Yeah.
We need that.
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, I also kind of make the point, and it's something that I've spoken to quite a few of my friends about, is this sort of collective awakening of our, for lack of a better word, sort of our connection to the land, connection to the earth, the fact that we are very much a part of it. It's happening. And I argue that, alongside so do my friends, that we cannot have this collective sort of awakening, this reconnection to the land, without recognizing the sovereignty of those who are best positioned to nurture it and whose cultures have, you know, tended to these lands for a long time. Because we have to start kind of moving beyond just reinstating the relationship for ourselves, but for others as well, who have been systematically erased because of their relationship to the land. You know, Indigenous folks in particular, and like, I interviewed quite a lot of Colombians for the book, many of whom I've had the utmost privilege of working with over the last few years. And Colombia is the most dangerous place to be an environmental defender, of which Indigenous people make up the majority of those who are killed in the pursuit for so-called environmental freedom. And it's really eye-opening, because I think that it makes you realize that the fear that people have of the future for climate change, you know, if in under the term eco-anxiety, may not necessarily speak to everyone who comes from a place where you can be murdered for simply protesting. Like many of my friends have attested to, fear of the police, fear of militia, fear of this. And it's like, is that not a fear? Is that eco-anxiety? I don't think it's eco-anxiety. So do I not get to talk about it? And it's like,
oh God, yeah. And I even read in the book something about you like not wanting to be in Hong Kong because of some of the repressive laws that would allow, you know, violators to be sent to China to be punished in some instances. Insane. Right.
Yeah, it's something that I've navigated for quite a while in this space, because, you know, my activism didn't start off as solely environmental, so to speak. It's been a culmination of many different things, but the reality is that as a Hong Konger, I always have to really like watch my back in what I say, and it's meant that in public forums, typically, I just can't speak about it, really. And and that's a sad reality, that, you know, the risk of arrest is something that I just can't really ignore it. You know, I left Hong Kong a few years ago, and, you know, there are many Hong Kongers who, we call them, are they yellow ribbon or are they blue ribbon? Yellow kind of represents the umbrella revolution, the people who are fighting against the national security law and extradition to mainland China. There are a lot of people who are fervently sort of committed to this new CCP rule, and I'm not going to go into like how much Sinophobia gets stoked by the West as well, because it's a very complex thing being a Hong Konger who's like under a repressive regime, but also realizes that the West has a role to play in stoking unnecessary. Yeah. It's complicated. Oh, wow. But the reality is that that's a real fear, and it's something that I think eco-anxiety doesn't lend itself to necessarily, but actually that, you know, we very briefly mentioned before we started talking, solastalgia.
Yeah, I was just going to bring up, yeah.
Yeah, which I think is a really interesting term because it kind of moves away from the futurity to talk about what has been lost.
And environments that have been lost, just for our listeners, right?
Right, exactly. And it's kind of its own neologism in that it combines this feeling of nostalgia with the environmental loss, nostalgia for a place that once was. And typically and physically, it can relate to environments that have been lost for people on the front lines. But it's also something that I've kind of adapted in my own ways to think about what it means to go back home now. To a social environment that is no longer what it once was. You know, I was literally having a call with my friend today who's from Hong Kong, and she went back quite recently. She doesn't live there anymore. Mm-hmm. And she was saying that just people are so depressed and it's just not what it once was. And it was just not a pleasant place to be. And, you know, all of these things. And it just makes you realize, damn, like that to me is a form of loss and change in and of itself. Like it's an environment that has changed. It's something that I was perhaps once nostalgic for growing up, you know, in Hong Kong for the best part of 19 years. So it's just not what it once was. And it's so nostalgia for me perhaps is something that resonates more with my feelings of grief than eco-anxiety. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Even in the instance here that we're talking about your life, being kind of in exile from your, you know, home, that you have very deep relationships to in with the ecosystem there and everything, lots of beautiful experiences that you write about in the book. Part of that solastalgia is created by repressive political systems that make it so you can't fucking be there. Like,
I know.
it's sadness about what has been lost, but it's also like tied into these political systems at the same time. So
completely.
Just shows how these things can't be disentangled.
Right. And maybe this is an invitation for scholars and academics and people who kind of say what's what on the basis of linguistics and vernacular to kind of be like, hey, maybe we need a more inclusive and intersectional understanding of this experience that we call eco-anxiety. It's something that has snowballed so much in terms of its popularity that it is the go-to for understanding eco-psychology in many ways. And if you can't necessarily change the words itself, maybe we can broaden the definition and folks can reclaim it in a way that makes sense to them. So there's hope yet. But in the meantime, I don't feel like public consciousness is there yet. And I feel like actually for a lot of people here in the UK, for instance, a lot of them are so-called waking up to the realities of the environmental and ecological and social emergency that we're in.
Yeah.
So what will it take for people to kind of get really knee deep in it? Well, that's why I'm always advocating for like the climate justice element, the climate campaigning, which is imbued in the social justice, which understands that the social injustice is the reason as to why we are having a climate crisis in the first place. And to also, you know, as we spoke about, get to the root of these issues and try and find a way out of this mess, which means smashing up the table and not taking a seat at it, you know?
Yeah. Cheers to that. I love that.
Yeah.
Smashing up the table. I'm going to think about that a lot.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could kind of explain for people why it is so problematic to call eco-anxiety a form of mental illness.
Yeah. I think for me, it's kind of in two parts. So the first part is, are we really going to pathologize what is perhaps in many ways a human and natural reaction to what it means to live in a really chaotic climate? Because that would be so problematic to me. It's just like, not only does it imply that reacting in a distressed way is bad but it also implies that it's kind of not the normal response to what is happening.
Yeah.
And
you're the messed
up
one.
I'm just like, if no one is feeling anything, I'm like, well, what's wrong with you? You know, I'm like, fundamentally, what is wrong with you? And the second thing is it plays into this pathologization that we have of human emotion, of that which is not obedient emotion, that which is divergent in some way. And that's very much a hallmark of the neoliberal capitalist society that we live in, which punishes deviance, which punishes critical thinking and thought of the injustice that faces us. And it can fall prey to exactly what society does as it is with so-called conventional mental illnesses. And I think, you know, if professionals are encouraging us not to designate eco-anxiety as an illness, can we not also extend that logic to the ways in which majority of people are told that, oh, they have an illness because they're depressed? And it's I'm not saying that these things don't manifest in people and that these things are sometimes unavoidable, but more, is this a detraction from the conditions that are making us unwell? Because to me, eco-anxiety and the likes of depression, anxiety, so many things, are not individual shortcomings. They're not failings because of our lack of resilience and capacity to deal with the environments that we're in. It is very much a product of a system that is making people very unwell, a crisis that has been abetted by this capitalist system, the climate crisis. And I just don't want us to be symptomatic about the way that we address things. I don't want us to be pathologizing about the way that we address things, because if we do so, we're essentially, again, detracting from the main culprits, the main perpetrators. And I think it's a huge disservice to people around the world who are marginalized, who exist at the intersections of many marginalizations, who are more predisposed to struggling with their mental health. You know, one statistic that I use in the book, which is just honestly mind-blowing, but sadly not surprising as well, is that Black folks of, I think it's Caribbean descent in the UK, are 9 times more likely to be diagnosed with schizophrenia.
Oh my God. Wow.
Yeah. Which is absurd, because
that's
it's
wild.
Like,
oh my God.
Right. Is it because they're genetically predisposed to developing schizophrenia? Or is it from living in a state, a policed state, that makes you paranoid incessantly? As a result of being racialized. Yeah. And I would be more inclined to agree with the latter, because there are so many mental health problems that come from discrimination and from state violence. So, you know, I think in the context of eco-anxiety, we have to be so careful not to veer into a territory where we tell people that this is their fault and that they're ill because they're reacting to what is ultimately a very unwell planet.
Yeah. I think your book is such a good appeal to making the argument that, like, the problem is not situated within you as an individual. The problem is situated within the bigger picture that you are born into and that you are having to cope with day in and day out.
Right.
You know, I actually saw like a TikTok video recently where the therapist was talking about how he's having to go around and talk with all these people who are struggling mentally because of their environment, because of the capitalist system that they're living within. And then he's having to like just talk to them about their personal problems and not really get to the root.
And
at the end of it, he's like, I'm not okay, guys. And it's just, it really touched me because this is someone who deeply cares about people's mental well-being and is seeing that the problem is much, much bigger than what he can tackle as a, you know, as a therapist, and how unwell they are having to deal with that whole situation is wild.
Right.
But that's the reality that we live in.
You know, I have a lot of respect for people who carry out healing work, whatever that means to them. And I can only imagine the burdens that people must feel and feeling responsible for a lot of people's well-being. And, you know, for me, it's really insidious because I don't know about you, but, you know, the times that I've been mentally unwell, it's either been rectified through the biochemical model of medication, or it's been, I've been put through so-called rigorous, like, behavioral routines and regimes, which say you have to adjust your mindset, you have to do this, you have to do this. And, you know, I would throw my all into them, being the unassuming and quite precocious person that I was. And I would come out the other side and be like, huh, I'm still fucking depressed. I don't understand why. And, you know, and we teach people that it is their individual fault, and therefore that requires individual solutions. But the reality is that for a lot of people, we essentially need to move away from this rhetoric that your mental health will be fixed by doing X, Y, Z. If you do these things, then you'll be fine. And what people really need is they need affordable housing, access to healthcare, like a stable income, access to that which we call nature and community and society. And especially regarding the latter, you know, there's scientific research which has shown that the communities which are most resilient in terms of crisis, whether that be so-called natural disasters or political or, you know, war, whatever it is, the ones that are the most resilient are the ones who have connections to community. But we live in a world which, you know, seeks to keep us industrious and separated. I mean, the very model of the way that we operate in society and the way that we live is geared towards heteronormative monogamy. And anyone who doesn't fall into those paradigms is going to have a very hard time and perhaps be very lonely unless they break out of those confines.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we're told that we have to do yoga, meditation, la la la. And they can be collective, for sure. I'm not denying that. But the reality is that when has anyone ever said, on a sort of governmental and, you know, systemic level in mainstream media, let's say, that, for instance, you don't want to be unwell in response to the climate crisis, well, maybe we should have a stable ecosystem, and actually the most responsible people are fossil fuel industry executives or something like that. You know, for me, dismantling the fossil fuel industry is a form of mental health care. You know, and I had to like really reiterate that one time because, you know, when it came to eco anxiety, people are like, what are your top tips and solutions for managing your eco anxiety? And they always want me to say something like, they're like, go for a walk in nature. Sometimes people like, go to a protest, which, don't get me wrong, I definitely feel like there's power in the action, but sustained action is something that I want to people to incorporate. Sustained action in a collective space, not just a one-off go to a protest, tick your box, you're fine now. No, like, how do we actually make that part of society? And people were really expecting me to be like, you know, have a bath and like use your reusable coffee cup and, you know, la 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 la. And don't get me wrong, whatever empowers you, right? But I was just like, I want the end to the fossil fuel industry. And they were like, they weren't really prepared for that.
That's why the comment that the person made about the, like, it would have been better if you just gave us the recipe for a Molotov cocktail. It's like, you're literally, that is what the book is. I mean, it's not the recipe of how to dismantle it, but like, this is like showing you, okay, these are the problems. Here, look at this. This is really the cause. And these are the real things that we need to be tackling.
You know, I never tout to give solutions. I just don't think you're ever going to find a book which gives you a silver bullet, a golden bullet, I don't know, color bullet. whatever color bullet solution. I'm not going to be that person. I also don't feel like it's my right in many ways. But what I will say is I know what the problems are. And if you do the math, you might be able to math and figure out that, okay, so this is a problem, so we need to move away from these problems. And that can look like a lot of different things for different people. And I do, you know, I do reiterate the collective, the community aspect. And in fair play to the person who critiqued my book, they're like, communities don't always get along. Communities don't always this. And I was like, I totally hear you. Like, we need to know how to be in community, manage nonviolent communication, actually act in a way that is reciprocal. You just can't throw a bunch of people together and be like, here, get along.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen a lot of the time. But, you know, instead of dissecting that and going into that in the book, I was trying to show people examples of where communities have had to come together, either because they've had no choice or because, you know, it's just part of their DNA. And mm-hmm. I'm hoping that people can look at those examples and kind of go, oh, I can kind of see a bit of similarity in my life here, or I kind of want more of that for myself. And I feel like climate organizing for me is a huge part of my community. And there was something really poignant, and I can't remember the person's name, but I saw it on Instagram, and it was this activist or organizer who basically spoke about how activism and this sort of incessant sort of action that as we know it is not sustainable in the capitalist system. And what they were trying to insinuate by that was that we need to have these structures which go beyond the sort of like go, go, go action. We need the mutual aid. We need the community networks. We need to show solidarity for one another. We need to have these structures. And if you have started doing this, you are going to be a lot more resilient, so to speak, when this world really comes to its halt. Let's put it that way. And I think with the book, I kind of intended to sort of shed light on those things in a similar vein, being like, if you are not building these structures now, you are going to have a very, very, very hard time in the future. If not, you're already having a very, very hard time right now, because the government won't save us.
Like, yeah.
The people who we beg and we plead and we, you know, throw our energy behind, they're not going to save us. And that is a sad reality. You know, the organizations that say they care about climate change, when there's money involved, they're at the mercy of whoever's funding them and whichever polluting corporation decides that they want to, you know.
Yeah.
It has to be about the units that are within your immediate vicinity or digital vicinity, let's say, because I just feel like, as we've seen time and time again in history, those with power, they're not here for us, they're here for themselves.
Yeah.
And I think that in order to tackle something as big as the climate crisis, even on a microcosmic level, we need to be doing it with people who have our backs, who are not here for themselves. So, you know, fair play to the person who was like, community isn't everything. It's not perfect. It's like, people, I get that. I totally get that. But it's still something that I think needs to be focused on, as opposed to these like weird pseudo solutions that are purported either from the mental health community and mental health and climate change community, or the climate community, which are just like, and I say climate community with a grain of salt here. I'm mainly referring to the sort of, you know, neoliberal capitalist sort of agenda people who will talk about, oh, well, we just need to green everything. And if you buy this, you know, reusable water bottle, you will save the world. And, you know, I just didn't want to focus on those quote unquote solutions, because I really feel like that's a disservice to people. Anyone who picks up the book, you know, I'm not going to give you top tips for how to placate yourself to numbness.
Oh gosh, yeah.
Yeah.
Just have a bubble bath, man. You know? Some wine and a bubble bath.
Literally. I mean, as someone who does like a bubble bath. And we'll probably, you know, have one later tonight or something.
Nice.
I'm like, that ain't a solution, you know? No. It's you know what it is? It's like carbon capture and storage. Everyone has kind of heard that this could be a big solution and, you know, whatever in climate change, taking the carbon from the atmosphere, storing it. It's really inefficient and the technology isn't there. I'm not saying that we won't have to do it. Like, we need every single solution, right? I mean, I have things that I'll prioritize over that, but I never talk about it. I never put it forward as a solution, because unfortunately it becomes a crux and an excuse to keep justifying consumption as usual, to keep justifying extraction as usual. And it's also just not really a solution.
And sometimes ramping up extraction.
Right, exactly. To the point where we literally have documents that were leaked from oil giants saying that they will use carbon capture and storage as a mean to expand their production. You know?
That's just like, oh, it's so frustrating.
Right.
It's like, oh, this thing that's touted as an environmental solution is just being used to wreck the planet even more.
Literally, literally. And I see all of these kind of like, quote unquote, innovations and commodified solutions and technologies as of that similar vein, where we're pushing for something which isn't a solution. And then you also have to ask, like, is it a solution for everyone? Definitely not. you know, there are people who are literally dying as we speak from these environmental atrocities, and they can't afford to wait for some guy to roll out, like, you know, loads of carbon capture storage machinery across the land. Which is just not gonna, you know, whilst not tackling the fact that extraction keeps happening. So from my bubble bath, I will ponder all the things about how we get there to, you know, free from all these commodified and technological so-called solutions.
Oh, shit, man. Maybe I should do the same thing today. Yeah. Or maybe I should just not think about any of those things for
The bathroom is, like, one of the best places to brainstorm, I swear. Like, you know, it's
always the shower that the ideas come to me.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Let's turn to talking directly about capitalism, which is, as you point out in this book, it's the root of why we are so mentally unwell for so many of us. And in the book, you have like a chapter, but also throughout the book, you're drilling home the message that, quote, it's not just you, it's the socioeconomic system. And you say, I believe that addressing the system is of utmost importance if we are to rectify the planetary and mental burdens of this crisis. So I was hoping you could just talk a little bit about how it's not just you, it's a socioeconomic system.
Yeah, for sure. So the title in and of itself has lent itself to easing people into the narrative of system change in the context of climate change. Because I kind of start off with this pillar of it's not just you, which is kind of like, you're not alone, it's okay to not be okay, which to me is one of the most necessary but innocuous forms of mental health dialogue that we see, this reassurance of, like, not being alone. And then it kind of expands that to go, well, okay, well, it's not just you, there's, you know, other perspectives, and, like, we need to employ a climate justice oriented and intersectional lens to unpack these issues. And then the third tenet of it's not just you is understanding that the system is making people incredibly unwell. And when I say that, you know, what I mean by that is yes, there's the capitalist system that we live in, which conspires with and abets, you know, racism and sexism and ableism and all of these systems of oppression that exacerbate people's mental illness, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, you were kind of saying, like, it's not just you is the antithesis to the system itself, the values of it's not just you, because the final tenet of it is this need to turn towards community, not only physically, but, you know, structurally as well, in terms of solutions as well. Because unfortunately, as I've mentioned, that the solutions that have been given to us aren't really solutions at all. They're individual forms of, you know, commodifying our issues.
Yeah.
And if we're to turn ourselves towards community, that is one of the most radical acts, because it essentially goes, hey, we're not going to participate in this system that is trying to make profit off of us in our absolute despair and misery.
Yeah.
Like, how radical is that idea that, you know, we don't need you, we have each other. Like, I feel like those values, and that's why I kind of say antithesis, those values are instrumental to kind of moving away from the system that we live in, and also challenging the narratives of what we've been told. I feel like far too often we see these narratives of what we're living in as unchangeable. And I kind of talk about capitalist realism in the book as well, with, like, not only how seen as the only viable system to live in, but that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism, which is why people are innovating green capitalist solutions in the face of a ongoing climate emergency. But also, capitalism creates the problems and then markets the solutions back to us. And I think this community tenet that I keep reiterating is just, like, it's our way out, guys. It's like this thing that teaches us that we have the capacity to resist a system that seems impenetrable. And it's why it's not just you has kind of gone almost like full circle from it's you're not alone, it's okay, to like, no, 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 seriously, you're not alone. Like, look at all these people here, look at all these people resisting, you know, this violence every single day.
Yeah. So I absolutely love that. I love that you really direct people to the collective remedies rather than the individualized solutions, and really point people towards collectivity, mutual aid, things that are going to build right. community. That is definitely, you know, something that we talk about a lot on the show and something that we absolutely need to be working towards as things get worse and worse under capitalism and as the climate crisis worsens. But I was wondering if maybe you could talk about the actual problems with capitalism. Like what, why is it always going to harm our mental health? Why is it always going to harm our material world?
This is a good question because I feel like, you know, sometimes to many of us, it might just seem like this no-brainer of like, oh yeah, of course yeah. it's bad. And then actually, when you really dig deep, there's so much to say about why it is actually not ideal. And in the context of, say, something like the climate crisis, and if we're going to go in kind of more ecological terms here, you know, capitalism is a system that relies on exploitation and in many instances, infinite growth. And there is no infinite growth on a finite planet. And, you know, when you're looking at the statistics of how we're consuming on this planet, I say we, but let's be real, like there's some very big consumers and some very little yeah. consumers.
Yeah.
But, you know, for the sake of the argument, we how we're consuming, we get to about May, right before, I think, the sort of middle half of the year. And we've already consumed 1.6 Earths or whatever yeah. it is in terms of resources that we have available.
Like what we can produce
planet.
Within a year.
Exactly. And, yeah. you know, from a biological and ecological perspective, we simply cannot sustain infinite growth. And then, you know, I go back to that thing I was saying about there are big consumers. It is important to reiterate that some people are more responsible than others. And what you find is the top percentile of wealth on this planet are the majority of carbon emissions. You know, with the likes of billionaires and millionaires being up there. And I named some billionaires on this planet who have investments, who, you know, have created a ginormous amount of impact on the planet, not only yeah. just in terms of the, like, the actual way that they influence the land, but also the carbon and ecological footprint of their endeavors. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But yet, when it comes to the term carbon footprint in and of itself, it's usually weaponized towards consumers because of the mm-hmm. fact that it was a very successful marketing campaign carried out
from
by
BP.
Ogilvy and Metho working for BP. Yeah.
Jeez,
so,
yeah.
you know, from the ecological perspective, it's not doing us any favors. And the other thing is capital relies on exploitation, as we've mentioned. And that's not just exploitation of resources, it's exploitation of human lives. And I've mentioned that it conspires with discriminatory systems in order to capitalize and exploit those human beings, those beings for capital gain. And in a system which has consistently relied on, you know, the subjugation and marginalization of humans for profit, there will be no climate justice without tackling that social injustice, without mm-hmm. liberating those people who are essentially the workers in the society that actually have the potential to hit capitalists hardest, you know? Like, you hit their profits, that's when things start to actually change. And uh-huh. I think that, for me, you know, I feel like in terms of the environmental movement as a whole, if we're not radically altering the means of production, if we're not radically altering the system that we live in, we're just going to continue with the same destructive behaviors and economies that are completely ruining this planet. Like, yeah. Yeah. There can't be any climate justice if you're, like, mining some of the most biodiverse regions on the planet and compromising and killing people at the same time, you yeah. know? Like, that's yeah. just not, that's not good for the planet. It's not also not very good for people's well-being, let's be frank. And when you treat people as commodities, you essentially strip them of their humanity. You strip them of their capacity to feel grief and pain, and strip them from the things that make them fundamentally human. And I think capitalism does a fantastic job of that, as we've seen with the way that we literally work in, you know, cubicles and boxes, yeah. take people away from nature, and have tried to also innovate solutions that are giving people, honestly, like, way less than they deserve. I like to give the example of, like, parks, for instance, you give people green spaces. That's also what they're called in, you know, in these terms, and they feel like they have enough. But to me, parks and these designated green spaces can actually be quite violent in many ways, because we convince people that all they need is to go for a walk around this little block of green, and then no, you know, it doesn't matter that they've completely decimated forests and ecosystems, you know, wildlife as well. It's just like, nope, we'll give them just enough to be happy. Any more or any less, you know, any more that's indulgence, any less, that then we'll start having problems. It's this like optimum. Do you know what I mean? So I just feel like we live in a system that's not good for people's mental health. And it can't be reiterated enough. Like, capitalism would not thrive unless there were marginalized people to exploit. Mm-hmm. It would not thrive unless we saw certain people as less value than others. It wouldn't thrive unless we lived in a world predominantly dictated by racial capitalism, where we have absolutely no problem getting Congolese people to mine for coltan whilst, you know, they're literally experiencing, you know, what in many ways could be considered a genocide. Being murdered, you know, violence is at an all-time high. So many people have died as a result for this hunger. And so, yeah, it just, for me, it's a no-brainer to kind of advocate for climate justice, because climate justice is inherently anti-capitalist. But equally so, we have to be so careful, because these kind of narratives get co-opted quite a lot. And it's something I'm super vigilant about and not always able to kind of catch it in its first instance. And then you kind of reflect and you're like, oh, shit, yeah, like we're all subject to being co-opted. And I think the only way that we can really keep climate justice radical and kind of rooted in the true values is through that community and the community accountability that comes with it, which is why I always kind of, and I'm not the first to interrogate this, but like the term climate activist in and of itself can sometimes be a disservice to climate organizing, because not all activists are organizers, but all organizers are activists. Without a lot of the rooting in the organizing and in the community, activism can easily be co-opted, because it's more of a statement or a stance than a commitment to the justice aspect of climate. So yeah, sorry, that was a very convoluted spiel.
No worries, dude.
Like,
I love
getting,
it.
Getting towards the end of my drink.
Nice. In addition to folks reading your amazing book, It's Not Just You, what else can they do to kind of plug into the work that you're doing, to follow you? Yeah, how should they find you?
That's a good question. You know what? I do have Instagram, but if I'm gonna make your energy concise and super, like, I don't know, worth your time, let's put it this way, I would prefer for people to follow the Stop Rosebank campaign. Interestingly, it's called Stop Cambo on Instagram. It's at Stop CAMBO, because that's a campaign that really needs people's momentum. It's to stop the Rosebank oil field in the North Sea, which I spoke about. And the reason why it's called Stop Cambo is because that was the oil field that we managed to shut down. That's, you know, something that we can all kind of get behind.
That's so fucking cool. I love that. Yeah. And I really want to do an episode just about Rosebank. So maybe you can help me out with some resources there in the future.
Hell yes, of course, of course. But it was so great to chat as well.
Oh my God, this has been such an amazing time for me. Like, I just feel like you're a kindred soul in this universe, where like so many of these things like that we're talking about, they occupy my brainwaves all the time. And then I just, and in this abstract way that I'm not even putting words to, but then you put it all to words and I'm like, oh
bless
yes,
you.
I found my person, you know.
Bless you. That's very kind, and likewise. And you know, you guys do amazing work, so always happy to be part of this.
Oh, I appreciate that. You know, thinking about Rosebank, this drink had rose tea in it. And we talked about the grapefruit. I don't know, I was thinking maybe we should substitute like blood orange there for because like,
for, like, the blood spilled as a result of, you know, oil.
Exactly.
Literally, like, it's very symbolic. Oh my God, yeah.
And the like oil being kind of like the blood of the earth, even like
Yeah, that's so true.
So that's maybe so true. Maybe we can modify this recipe and have that be the official. It's not just you.
Oh my God, yeah, for sure. For sure.
Awesome, dude. Well, this has been so amazing. I appreciate you so goddamn much, Tori.
And thank you.
I hope you keep up the good fight and that you you know that the struggle isn't too heavy and on your soul, on your heart, on your mind, because I know how big your heart is. So
bless you. Yeah. Thank you. And you as well. Like, just tap into those networks, those people who are like accepting your grief as it is in the moment and mm-hmm. finding ways to turn that grief into solidarity and action.
Yeah. Fuck yeah. Cheers to
Thank
that,
you
man.
So much. All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for tuning into this anti-capitalist project. To remain independent and free from the corrupting influence of corporations, Cocktails and Capitalism has rejected the corporate advertising model. Instead, we've decided that the only ethical approach to funding our work is through the kind support of listeners like you and revolutionary groups that embody our values. This show was sponsored by Beautiful Trouble, an international network of organizers, artists, and trainers working to equip grassroots movements with the tools to become more creative, effective, and irresistible. If you value the work that we're doing here at Cocktails and Capitalism, we would deeply appreciate any amount you're able to contribute through Patreon, even if it's only a dollar a month. This project involves a massive amount of research, networking, content creation, and editing, all of which has been done by myself and a small team of volunteers. None of us have been paid for our time and labor, but I hope to make this work more financially sustainable in the future. You can lend a hand by signing up on Patreon or by purchasing merch through my friend's shop, Punk with a Camera, which I've linked in the show notes. For those of you who are unable to contribute financially, which is totally understandable in this fucked up economy, you can still support the show by giving us a rating and writing a review on Apple and Spotify. Doing this would really help to increase our visibility. This anti-capitalist project is still quite small, so telling your friends about it can actually make a significant difference. Please follow us on Instagram, where I'm most active, as well as Threads, TikTok, and Twitter. That's right, fuck you, Elon. As those of you who are following already know, suppression of the kind of content we talk about on the show is rampant on social media. By engaging with and sharing our posts, you can help to counter this repression while inviting others to learn about the current anti-capitalist struggles for social and environmental justice. Big thanks to John, our producer and audio editor, Jesse Torres, our resident anti-capitalist bartender, Dread, our video editor, and Anthony, who's been helping me with social media. To all of our existing patrons, thank you so goddamn much. Your support truly helps to keep this anti-capitalist independent media project alive. Much love to you all. Cheers and solidarity forever.